From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Olympic opening ceremonies are always over the top now, it seems. Russia's in Sochi on Friday night, no exception. Cossacks and cosmonauts, ballerinas and onion domes, policemen singing Daft Punk, a ring that wouldn't open. But a lot of money and power and Russian-ness on display under the eye of Vladimir Putin and the world. This hour on Point, Sochi, the Olympics, and Putin's Russia. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in Sochi, behind Sochi, in Vladimir Putin's Russia? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us first today from Sochi is John Sherva, Olympic Bureau Chief for the Tribune newspaper, Chicago Tribune, LA Times, Orlando Sentinel, Deputy Sports Editor at the LA Times. Sochi is his eighth Olympic Games. He helped us to prep for the Games. Now they're on. John, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I'm glad to be back.
So we're seeing all kinds of reporting here about doorknobs falling off and rings that won't light up, but also seeing terrific vistas and some terrific winter sport. What's your sense of how the Games are going so far, John?
You know, it was a difficult lead-up. I mean, they had a lot of problems. There's still stuff that's not finished. But as far as the actual competition's going, it's great. The venues are all working. As a matter of fact, the venues were completed before the roads around them were completed. But, you know, I think we have pretty much settled into kind of a usual Olympic routine. This doesn't seem too terribly different than any of the others.
There's still, coming out of Washington, the sound of warnings about terrorism. Any whisper of that inside the Olympic bubble?
Well, that is something that I completely misjudged on, I think. At least I hope I did. I had some trepidation going over, but this is, I feel totally, completely secure here in the bubble. And as a matter of fact, I was just talking to my colleague from the Chicago Tribune, who basically came over with the same feeling and says, you know, you don't even think about it anymore. And the thing is, it's not oppressive. I mean, we would see nonstop military and police. Nope. It's really just like any other games.
What are the athletes there telling you, saying to you about the opening ceremonies on Friday night? Millions and millions watch them around the world, many in the United States. What about the athletes? What do they think of the whole spectacle?
Well, they liked it. You know, the thing is, you don't have your full contingent there at an opening ceremony. For example, like the hockey team, the men's hockey team wasn't here. The women's hockey team was playing the next day, so they weren't there. But the people who were in the stadium really enjoyed it, except for the fact that they were doing some things that meant they had to pump cold air in an already cold stadium. So it was one of the more frigid opening ceremonies. And something else they did differently is they moved up the athlete march earlier, and then rather than having them stand, they put them in the seats. So that was a better experience for them.
You've seen, this is your, I guess, your eighth Olympics now. Compare and contrast opening ceremonies, mood, facilities. How does Sochi look?
You know, the opening ceremony is always, you know, can you top this? And you know, they just get more and more crazy. The one thing, you know, I could have done without the 12 minutes of reenactment of War and Peace, but, you know, for the most part, they should have done Anna Karenina. It would have been a better story. But now the thing is that I think these games are pretty much, you know, as they should be. I think that my overriding feeling is we're at the same place that we normally are. But it's getting there that has been the struggle. You know, it's just things do not come easily in Russia. Getting things done does not come easily. And I think we're all feeling a sense of that. You know, again, I think it's business as usual.
The gay rights issue and Russia's anti-gay propaganda law, as they put it, is that in the air? Is it being talked about or shunted aside at this point?
I think it's totally in the background. No one's talked about it, or very few people are talking about it. There hasn't been any demonstrations that I'm aware of. Now, of course, we are only on the third day of competition,
yep.
And there are many more chances for that. But, you know, even like tomorrow, there's a gay ski jumper who basically was asked one question about, you know, about your partner, and she said, yeah, well, you know, no, no big deal, you know. So even that hasn't really, you know, been much of an issue.
And what about the hoary issue of the medal count? How's that looking? How's the U.S. doing? Russia, for that matter? What's striking on the performance side so far?
Well, Norway. Norway's just killing, but they are involved in the sports that, well, we don't really care about, you know, which is like cross-country and biathlon. The Dutch are doing really well in speed skating.
Yeah.
The U.S., you know, swept the slope style, the snowboard slope style. That was Sage Katzenberg and Jamie Anderson.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a surprise. I don't think we expected that to happen. They picked, I don't want to do a spoiler alert, but we picked up a bronze in the women's combined alpine this morning. So, you know, the U.S. is doing okay. They picked up a team medal in figure skating, but probably won't do anything in the men's and the women's, but they will probably win gold in ice dance in a couple days.
And what's the anticipation? I know it's a while yet, but still on hockey. Well, there's women's and then there's men's. What's the anticipation there?
Well, there's no question that it's a two-team race in women's hockey, U.S. and Canada. U.S. won, I believe, 9-0 over Switzerland today. And that was the team that Canada beat 5-0 the other day. So it's going to come down to that game. They'll play once in pool play, and then undoubtedly will play for the gold. The men, it's a little tough. I personally think that Russia, who's not the favorite, Canada's the favorite, I think the gold medal game will be Canada and Russia, because you know, the crowd is just going to be unbelievable, you know, for the Russians, and that would be a good game. Again, it's just sort of a mishmash of NHL players. So.
A lot of snow and ice flying, and a lot more to come. John Sherwa there in Sochi with the Tribune newspapers. John, thanks for all your reporting running up to the games, and for joining us today. Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
With us now in the studio, with me in the studio, Gregory Pfeiffer, Europe editor for Global Post and author of the new book, Russians, The People Behind the Power. He was Moscow correspondent for NPR from 2005 to 2009. You can read an excerpt of his new book at our website, onpointradio.org. Gregory Pfeiffer, it's wonderful to have you right here. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And with us from Sochi in Russia, Julia Yaffe, senior editor at The New Republic, former Moscow correspondent for Foreign Policy and The New Yorker. Julia Yaffe in Sochi, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Julia, what's your sense of Sochi so far and these games?
Well, you know, I was expecting a lot worse, frankly, having lived in Russia for a few years. And, you know, as a prior guest, I think John was saying how difficult it is to get things done here. It looks pretty good. I know they had some trouble with the hotels earlier, but you don't really see that. The Olympic venues look beautiful and gleaming. There don't seem to be any problems. Sochi itself, it's about half an hour away from Adler, where one of the Olympic hubs is. The other is up in the mountains. Is also looking very festive. People are walking around and enjoying the taking in the games. I'm in a cafe now where there's a bunch of, even though it's Monday, a bunch of locals gathered at the cafe watching the competitions on the screen. They were here for the Olympic ceremonies, all standing up and hollering the Russian national anthem. People are really excited.
Julia, you've reported sort of vociferously on Western or international coverage of the games. You've said, you know, maybe too much of this schadenfreude about problems in advance of the games. We always hear that, I guess, wherever they are. Do you think global coverage has been fair or unfair to Sochi and Russia?
I think now it's calmed down a bit. But before, when people got here, it seemed that people were just looking for, you know, for the things that were broken, for the things that were off. And it's okay to report that. I mean, if it's broken or if it's not ready, you should report it. The question for me was the tone and the glee with which a lot of this stuff was reported. The word hilarious in the headlines when reporting about, you know, upside down toilet lids. You know, you're either reporting on the readiness or about how clumsy and stupid the Russians are. And it seemed to me that a lot of the coverage before the game started was in the camp. And I know that a lot of my Russian friends who are vociferous critics of the Kremlin were a little bit offended by the coverage, as well as some, you know, Westerners who've spent a lot of time here were also a little bit off-put by that.
Julius,
but now I think people are just back to covering sports.
Yeah, stand by there. Gregory Pfeiffer, anybody who watched the opening ceremony saw Vladimir Putin sitting there watching over the whole thing in very prominent position. Put yourself in his shoes for a minute. Do you think, a lot of money invested here, a lot of pride invested here. Is this unfolding to Putin's liking so far, Gregory, or not?
I would suspect very much so. We must remember when these games were awarded. It was in 2007, mm-hmm. just when Russia was reaching the height of its post-Soviet oil-fueled resurgence. And it was also a time when Putin was getting ready to step down for a term. It was the end of his term limit. He had served two terms, and mm-hmm. he was trying to think of ways of how to boost his personal power to be able to come back in 4 years. And winning the Sochi Games was very much a part of this. 7 years later, after 7 years of preparations, I think he's very happy and very much on top of things.
And come back he has. Julia Yaffe there in Sochi, we're so glad for you to join us for a few minutes here. Our line's a little rough. I'm going to let you go, Julia, but we're very grateful to you for being with us for a few minutes here. Thanks so much, Julia.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Sochi, the Olympics, and Vladimir Putin's Russia behind the games, beyond the boundaries of the Olympic bubble, where so much sport is going on right now. My guest is Gregory Pfeiffer, former NPR bureau chief, correspondent in Moscow from 2005 to 2009. He's seen Russia for a long time. He's out with a wonderful new book, Russians, The People Behind the Power, coming out in just a few days here. You can read an excerpt today at our website, onpointradio.org. Gregory Pfeiffer is with me in the studio, and we were listening over the weekend to American officials talking about this, and at least from some, this was a Texas Republican Congressman Michael McCaul, chair of the House Homeland Security Committee. The big deal was still on Fox News Sunday about a terror threat to the games.
The fact is, right now, Chris, the eyes of the world are upon these Olympics, and the Chechen extremists know this, and they want to make a global statement. They want to make a jihad statement, and what better time to do it than right now? And that is, I think, the biggest threat to these Olympics. And remember, they don't have to hit in the Ring of Steel at the Olympic Village. As long as they hit somewhere in Russia, to them, that's a victory.
Chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Congressman Michael McCaul there. So, Gregory, here we have no hit really so far on this front. It drives the Russians crazy, from what I've seen in the last week, for American officials to keep talking about the threat. On the other hand, they put the games here right up against a region on the underbelly of Russia there that has been historically riddled with problems, and not least under Vladimir Putin. Just take on the security piece for a minute here, how that looks so far.
Of course, we have no idea what's going to happen, and predicting anything is futile. But as I was saying earlier, as we've discussed, this is very much Putin's personal project, very much a part of his creating his image as Russia's national leader. I think holding the Olympics so close to an act of rebellion, this has never been done before, is part of his sort of feat of will, along with holding a winter event in a subtropical resort. This is Putin showing that he has total control. But I think that one of the positive, if you can mm-hmm. call it that way, developments from the coverage of leading up to the games is that it's drawn attention to what's going on in the North Caucasus, where there is violence going
Dagestan,
on.
Dagestan, Chechnya.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All of these regions where violence has, under Vladimir Putin, spread out of Chechnya, the once separatist region, into the other surrounding regions. And the reason is, as I see it, I've been there many times, mm-hmm. is that the corrupt rule of Putin, pro-Kremlin loyalists in this region is very much oppressing the local population. I'll just give you a little example. I was recently in a tiny little village high up in the Caucasus Mountains in Dagestan, which is now—
Right next door,
which is now, by all accounts, the most violent of all the regions. And this village was in an area where the security forces were trying to find some of these militants, not very many of them in the mountains, maybe a few hundred.
Yep. And
what they did was to surround this village with a cordon for about a year. It was called a counter-terrorist cordon. They had blocked it off, so any residents who wanted to leave had to get special permission.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers camped out there, cut down trees, apricot trees, killed livestock, and harassed the local population. Well, the result of this, they didn't find a single militant. But after a year, the entire village converted to Salafi Islam, an extreme form of
which Russia's most worried about. That's the thing they don't want.
Exactly. And this is Russia's greatest security threat in the entire country, but here in the Caucasus. And another development that that took place at the same time was that there was a dispute between that village and another village. A young man in one of the villages fell in love with a young woman in the other one. Her brothers didn't approve. There was a shootout. Things got ugly. A couple of people died. Now, instead of just a sort of a local disagreement, now this was the Salafi village against the traditional, more moderate Sufi village. And so you could see the society literally tearing apart at the seams, thanks very much to Vladimir Putin.
Gregory, you talked about 2007 when Russia went for these games. Vladimir Putin himself went to, was it Guatemala, I think, where they were meeting, charmed the Olympic Committee, speaking English and French, the official languages of the Olympics, won the Olympics. So that was a moment at which Russia was at the height of its oil and gas revenues, rolling in dough. Putin had come in and had his two terms. Where do the Sochi Olympics find Russia?
It is a different place now. Putin has been in power for 14 years. His popularity isn't as high as it was around that time when it was he had approval ratings of pushing 90%. I think they went above 90%. Now it's more around 60%, closer to what it was during his first term. The country is in a different place too. The oil-fueled, oil and gas-fueled resurgence is now under threat. Economic growth is slowing. Global prices for oil are fluctuating. Look, in 2005, the Kremlin, the Moscow, could balance its federal budget when oil was at around, if I'm not mistaken, it was around $20 a barrel.
Wow.
Now they can balance it only when oil is around $105 a barrel, and it's sort of hovering around $108. So they're very worried that if oil prices fall, they're not going to be able to fulfill a lot of Putin's campaign promises. And so it's a different place. And I think for that reason, the success or the perceived success of these opening ceremonies are important for Putin's personal power.
We don't think of Russia as maybe incorrectly. We don't think of it as a country with a huge social safety net. What's Russia spending all that money on if they have to have oil up at $105 a barrel to support the state that Putin's created?
That's a very good question. Look, and I think that John was talking about how the preparations for these Olympic Games were very slow. And I think in some ways, or in a lot of ways, these games reflect what's going on across Russia. We do know that these were the most expensive Olympic Games ever staged, ever held.
$50 billion.
$50 billion.
Is that all government money? We hear about private investors in these games as well.
That's right. Private investors have been dragooned into building airports, some of Russia's oligarchs, highways, and some of the venues.
You made money off this state. Now you will support the great cause by investing here.
Exactly. But money also went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
We know that 70 $7 billion of state contracts went to companies connected to one man. Now, $7 billion, that's around the amount of the what was spent for the entire 2010 Vancouver Olympic Games.
Wow.
So that's a lot of money.
To one man who is what? In the circle of
exactly
Putin? Or
exactly.
I don't want to assume that.
Well, I mean, it's a very good assumption. This was Putin's childhood friend and former judo partner. So, you know, this gives you an idea of the kind of things that are happening in Russia. The former central banker. Now, this isn't some. This isn't just a sort of an independent economist or a watchdog like Transparency International. This is a former central banker said that in 2012. Around $50 billion was sent illegally out of the country, and that this was done by a group of what he called well-organized individuals. So, you know, Russia is an incredibly corrupt country. A joke has a newspaper reporting Putin's latest reform program.
Yeah.
It said that the aim of the program was to make people happy and rich. And then it said, see list of people attached. Now, the question is
– not all people.
Not all people. A very small circle of his friends. The question is, how does he get away with it? You know, Russia is a mystery to, I think, many Americans. We don't know why Russians continue to support an authoritarian leader two decades after the Soviet collapse. Does that mean they've learned nothing from their very painful past? In my book, I've tried to look at daily behavior, Russians at work, family life, drinking, things like that. And it seems to me that what's clear is that although Russians' way of doing things seems confusing and chaotic to us, I think it's very successful at achieving its own aims. Now, these aren't Western aims. I think Russians have different values and they have different motives than we do. I'll just give you an example. The conventional wisdom is that Putin rules according to a social contract with the people. As long as living standards continue rising thanks to Russia's vast energy reserves, its profits, Putin and his cronies are free to be as authoritarian as they like inside the Kremlin. I don't think that's exactly right. I think the glue binding Putin's regime to the people is corruption. Corruption not only enables the authorities to coerce the people because anybody can be prosecuted. I think we're safe to say almost every single Russian has to pay a bribe if you're stopped by the traffic police to get off. If you own a corner store, you've got to pay the fire inspector, the building code inspector, the health safety inspector. Everybody's engaged in this tremendous machine of corruption, which enables the Kremlin to top down, have something hanging over the heads of everybody. But I think it also co-opts people because if you're part of this system, you get something out of it too. So I think that this system is very central to how the Kremlin rules.
Back up for a second here. Then you say, okay, they're succeeding not in Western aims but in their own aims. And then you tell us that the central glue of the whole country is corruption. Do Russians really embrace this? What ideals? I mean, most countries have some kind of appeal to an ideal. And it may be hypocritical sometimes. It may be observed only in the breach. But there's some ideal that pulls people together. Corruption as a central organizing principle?
That's right. Well, it's certainly not an ideal, and I don't think Russians would openly say this. I will say, I mean, this, you know, there are certain indicators that Russians aren't as displeased with the system as we would think. A recent poll said that more than 70% of respondents said that they wouldn't take part in protests to criticize falling living standards or human rights. So, I think this gives you an idea of the sentiments of Russians. I think we read a lot of our values and ideas into what Russians do, and as I say, I think they're different.
Gregory, let's go to our callers, if I may. Darren in Bentonville, Arkansas. Darren, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just curious to hear some responses about the parody on The Onion about the stabbing of the engineer and what that does to the publicity of the games.
An Onion parody, what, that the engineer responsible for the fifth ring not opening was stabbed, you're saying, Darren?
Yes, found stabbed to death.
Okay. Onion parody. But, you know, Darren, thank you. Gregory, I'm sure a lot of people that night in the United States made jokes about that. Oh, ring didn't open. Somebody's going to the gulag. I heard that joke during the opening ceremonies. Is that crazy these days? Or, I mean, also the police choir, some of those policemen singing, got all the attention singing, you know, Get Lucky, looked petrified as they were singing. Maybe that's just cultural, too. Is this an old-fashioned understanding of Russia or reasonable point for parody?
I think a bit of both. I mean, I think that things are going to go wrong in every Olympics, and I think the Russians know this. But, you know, I think that one of the troubles that we have when we look at what's going on in Russia is that it's very hard to know exactly what's going on. And I think that there's a reason for that. Part of the reason I think that the Russia is a different place than Western countries is that secrecy, in a sense, is central to how things are done. And then I think Putin is a great student of this. I think one of the reasons he's been in power for 14 years is he understands the Russian culture very well. Now, look, today we see him as a sort of a caricature of this aging dictator type. And
still throwing his shirt off and going wrestling with leopards or whatever the latest thing was.
Exactly. And I think a lot of the parody, a lot of the satire, a lot of the jokes are well-deserved. And I think it's good that we're paying attention to Russia. But look, and in his first term, when he was doing very similarly autocratic things, he sent the tax police after all the Russian leading companies. He shut down the leading independent newspaper, television station. He went after his political opponents, some of whom were arrested. Others went into exile. He was doing exactly the kinds of things that he was doing now, and yet he was lauded as this great reformer. When he went to visit Tony Blair in London in 2003, the Times of London hailed him as the greatest Russian ruler since Alexander II, who freed the serfs in 1861.
Because he was bringing Russia out of what was then perceived as the chaos after the end of the Cold War?
Exactly. He had sort of created this myth that the 1990s were a time of chaos and complete corruption. They were a time of chaos and corruption. What Putin did was to come in and compound that corruption and put himself at the top of the pile, essentially. But he created this myth that he came and cleaned things up, and it just wasn't true. And it shows him to be very much a master of appearances. And I think that's a very a common trait among Russian leaders that goes back centuries.
So there are many kinds of Russians. I'm reading Russians here who are appalled at the spending on Sochi, saying, look what we could have done with that $50 billion, could have done all these other things. But what's your sense of how different Russians look at these games? Crowning achievement, Russia's back, Russia's on the top of its game again, or, you know, Putin celebrating himself and his circle with an incredibly expensive party?
I think all of those things. I mean, I think that Russians understand that these games are very corrupt. I think that we might think of Russia now as a this sort of oil-fueled power, and in many ways it is. If you go to Moscow, the streets are crammed with luxury cars, essentially standing still in huge traffic jams. It has fabulous and fabulously expensive restaurants and nightclubs. But you drive out of Moscow, and there's poverty everywhere. Villages are dying, and I think Russians understand that.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Sochi, the Olympics, and Vladimir Putin's Russia behind the games with Gregory Pfeiffer, former NPR correspondent in Moscow. He's out with a new book, Russians, The People Behind the Power, coming out this month. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Gregory Pfeiffer is with me in the studio. Is there an economy beyond oil and gas? Is this a Saudi Arabia that's entirely dependent on that, Putin's whole, not just Sochi, but the whole thing? Or is there something growing up behind it? Or maybe they don't even need it. Maybe there's so much gas, the money lasts forever.
That's a central question. No, there isn't much of an economy. The majority of Russia's profits, income, comes from the sale of oil and gas. And there was great hope that when oil prices started rising right around 2000, that Russia would use a huge windfall in developing new industries, investing in infrastructure, and it simply hasn't been done. And this is one of the reasons why the Kremlin, the government, is very, very concerned about the price of oil. Now, Putin has made a tremendous list of very expensive promises before his election, re-election for a third term in 2012. And I think this is something, you know, being able to fulfill that those promises is important. I think they feel that it's important for Putin to maintain his authority, and they're worried about
it. Are the promises about building industry or just building out more amenities on the back of oil and gas revenue?
Exactly. More amenities, more promises of greater social spending on the pension system, things like that.
Let's go to Andy in Newport, Rhode Island. Andy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm engaged to a first-generation Russian immigrant, and she would probably agree with a lot of the comments of your guest, that Putin is not on the straight and narrow, and it's a very corrupt country, and I visited there with her this past summer, and the one thing that's blown her away about these Olympics is the propaganda machine here in America. You know, she came here, obviously, because Russia is so corrupt and because it's not a straight and narrow place, and she sees a better opportunity here, but...
Yeah.
She has noticed that on the MSNBC, the Today Show. I mean, every one of these outlets is very quick to point out every tiny little flaw. Yes, the hotels weren't built. Yes, there's dogs running around Sochi. But it seems like all the media outlets are just focusing on that. I mean, one little ring, one little snowflake didn't turn into the ring of the Olympics. And that's the big story. It's not about the grand, the grand opening that was so beautiful and so amazing. It seems like we are just beating them down for every little thing. Yes, she would agree with everything else your guest says regarding Putin and Russia itself, but regarding the Olympics, it seems like they're getting a really bad rap.
Attitudes still set against one another here in many ways, all these years after the Cold War. Andy, I appreciate your call. Gregory Pfeiffer, your mom's a Russian immigrant. It's not as though you come from a family where there's not... I mean, she left, like our caller's fiancé, but there's still cultural sympathy here. What about the presentation of Russia? I mean, I've got all kinds of listeners online saying, you know, if anything, Russia should be facing more scrutiny, turning away the eyes of the world from torture of gay people, corruption, financial the interference in the Ukraine, and then others saying, even the facilities, look, it's just not up to snuff. On the other hand, it can sound like almost a celebration of Russia's problems sometimes in the American media. How do you look at it, Gregory?
Well, I have to say I very much agree with the caller's points, both about the our brand of nationalism and also about the attention to every single problem. Look, there are countless journalists in Sochi. It's at the center of the world's attention right now. And, as journalists, we're always looking for a new angle. That was the new angle for a while. Now, of course, attention is focused on the games. And there's criticism of all the sort of making fun of the mistakes in building Russian toilets and so on and so forth.
People are saying you don't have the basics. So you got rebar sticking out, And I mean, here Suzanne says, look at the photos. Tell me that anything like this has happened at previous Olympics. She's shocked by the lack of readiness.
I think if we go, do a Google search about the coverage of previous Olympics. Look, the previous Summer Olympics in London, there was a whole load of criticism about what was going to happen to the traffic, what was going to happen to the underground metro, and then once the game started, it sort of faded away. And I think we're seeing some of this going on. But to me, what's important to me is the stories, the sort of the real stories behind what's going on. One of them is this sort of Cold War tit for tat going on between the U.S. And Russia. We saw that That Russia released a recording of two American diplomats, the Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and the ambassador to Ukraine in Kiev.
Bad-mouthing the EU over Ukraine and appearing to take sides in Ukraine's struggle.
Exactly. And this was timed just before the opening ceremony. I think what was more damning than the bad-mouthing of the EU was that it showed American diplomats appearing to scheme about installing opposition leaders in power in Ukraine. And this very much fits the Russian narrative that the U.S. is meddling in Ukraine, that it's doing what it shouldn't be doing. And being released just before the opening ceremonies allowed Putin to sort of fully bask in the glory of the world's media attention of the opening ceremonies. And I think the opening ceremonies were, although they were very much to do with showing Russia to be a place with a unique history and culture, and so don't criticize us, please. I think the real message was directed at Russians. There were a lot of nuances there that foreigners watching wouldn't get. And I think for the home audience, it was very much about presenting Russian history as this unbroken line of progression from, well, actually all the way back to the ancient Greeks to today, to Putin's rule. And it was very much about glorifying what Putin has done.
You're talking about opening ceremonies there, but when you describe the Russia behind outside these games, I mean, one of the questions you ask in your book, and as I listen to it, it seems a reasonable question. It says, will Russia, you ask, forever be separated from the West? I mean, we had all the talk of reset. There was the end of the Cold War and the idea that there'd be democracy developing here. And here you come, Gregory Pfeiffer, for this to tell us, well, maybe not. Maybe you've got a country where corruption is the glue, where authoritarianism remains admired, that puts Russia in a kind of what can look like an eternally adversarial pose with the West.
Well, look,
that we don't have our problems, but still.
Sure. I was saying earlier that you drive just a few miles outside of Moscow, and I've been to many of these places that used to be once bustling villages, now they're sort of a muddy track with abandoned houses and just maybe two elderly people living in what looks like a wasteland. I mean, the countryside is literally dying. So that's very much a kind of place that Russia is.
And Russia's okay with that? Russians are okay with that? Maybe they're just moving to somewhere better.
Well, look, I don't think that there is that Russia is fated to be the way it is. I don't believe that there is a Russian soul. A lot of or some people say, well, look, Russians have a unique soul, and that explains why we don't understand what's going on because it's different. I think Russia is the way it is for practical reasons. It has a system that works for its leaders, that provides stability in the face of overwhelming odds. It's a huge country, the world's greatest country by territory, with a lot of its territory uninhabitable. I mean, a lot of it is marshland, tundra. It's got a terrible, terrible climate. The odds of surviving in Russia are very tough. I think that there are reasons that Russia is the way it is. Of course, these won't change. But as I said, I think it's the way Russians act is eminently explainable. And I think that under the right circumstances, things can change. I think in the 1990s, Russia had a chance to change. There was enough going on under Boris Yeltsin, who's much maligned now. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of westernization. I'll give you just one mm-hmm. little example. For the first time under Yeltsin, the Moscow, the center, controlled the regions bargaining over money, over fiscal policy, how much federal money would be spent in the regions, mm-hmm. how much tax money would they send back. Now, this was something very, very different. Russia had always controlled the regions with an iron fist, and I think things were changing in the 90s. When Putin came back, he reinstituted this very traditional political culture.
Central control,
the way things have been done for centuries. And I think that so far he's been very successful. That doesn't mean that it can't change in the future.
Let's go to Anthony, calling from Rochester, New York. Anthony, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I think we can all stipulate that Putin is a wretched man and his system of government is corrupted. But once those athletes enter the arena, I should think that our attention would be on their sport. I followed everything associated with the history of Sochi, the genocide, even, of moving all of those people out of Sochi, and I'm appalled by all of that history. But for 1 week or a week and a half, when we have all those athletes there, perhaps we could hear something about the athletes. One last point is, when the guest described the corruption that has led to the wealth in Moscow, I immediately brought to mind Manhattan, congested with limousine wealth, while we here in upstate New York are suffering remarkable job decline and poverty. It's kind of relative to the country that you would be addressing, any country.
So be careful about throwing stones. Anthony, I've got it, and I appreciate your call on both those fronts. I mean, we talked with athletes before the games began. NBC's kind of got a lock on a lot of that tape right now, and there's a lot of attention to it right there. We're also looking at it as an opportunity to look beyond that to Russia at a moment where people are paying more attention than usual and may be interested. But what about our caller's point, Gregory, on, hey, look beyond the golden towers of Manhattan or even between them, and you'll find inequalities in this country as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about Russia because the Olympic Games are going on now, I think it's right to highlight the problems. I also agree that, yeah, I mean, the Olympics are about the sports, and we should be interested in that too. I don't think it's wrong to sort of use the attention to criticize what's going on in Russia. And I think one of the things that maybe the games can help do is get us to try to look at what's behind this facade of what's going on, the pomp and the circumstance of the opening ceremony and Putin's power and that kind of thing.
Serge is calling from Cambridge, Ontario in Canada. Serge, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Well, I'm 28 years old, and I'm just wondering, I've been in Canada for 10 years, and I've heard all kind of different stuff, you know, that Russia is bad and stuff like that. But Russia is not that bad, though, to think about it. It never, you know, was like comparing Stalin, he only sent 40,000 people into gulags, but he never dropped a single nuclear bomb on the civilian people. Then we never had slaves, never. We were against it all in the history. We never had those, wars in the name of the religion when people go to Israel and kill Muslims. We never had that. So how come Russia, in everybody's eyes, are so freaking bad?
Serge, I appreciate your call. Gregory Pfeiffer, I don't know what to say about that exactly. No, didn't drop a nuclear bomb. Stalin's history is no walk in the park. But Russia's not that bad, you can hear Serge saying. If we went to Moscow, is that what we would hear?
Well, that's very much the Kremlin's line. I mean, Putin's himself has said, look, you know, we didn't drop an atomic bomb. So how can you possibly ever criticize us about our human rights record? About slaves, Russia had serfs for centuries. Russia did have slaves for a very, very long time. They were freed in 1861. One of the results of this was that most Russians until the beginning of the 20th century were desperately poor peasants. I mean, 80% of the population consisted of peasants around the turn of the century. That's a complicated question, but there were serfs. Russia is not an enlightened place. I think that it is fair that the Olympics is drawing attention to what's going on there, and they're very important things. I mean, I said earlier that there's this sort of Cold War tit for tat going on over Ukraine, also about Russia's anti-gay law and those kinds of things. But there are tremendous things at stake here. Vladimir Putin has essentially coerced, bribed, however you want to call it, Ukraine into dropping an agreement with the EU using money and threats. And he's essentially pushed the country toward the verge of civil war now.
It's attempting to bring it back within Russia's fold.
Exactly. Very much so. You would think, well, this isn't a very good thing for Russia. I mean, let alone Ukraine. This is disastrous, let alone the region and the world. This would be a bad thing to have a civil war on the border of Russia.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that it shows is that Putin very much does things in his interests, not in the country's. We often wonder, well, why does he threaten to direct nuclear missiles at Western Europe? Why does he cut off gas to Ukraine? Why is he trying to prompt a kind of Cold War rivalry with the United States? And again, it's good for Putin and it's bad for Russia. And why is it good for Putin? Well, because nationalism is popular. I don't want to criticize Russian society. I'm just pointing these things out. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of envy toward the West. There's a lot of dislike. It's understandable why. Russia used to be a great when it was the Soviet Union, part of the Soviet Union. It was a great superpower, and Russians are understandably nostalgic for that time. Putin has exploited that. The anti-gay law. Two-thirds of Russians think that homosexuality is morally unacceptable. So what Putin is doing has very, as I said, practical reasons.
And on the other side of the Olympics, there have been some releases. A couple of Pussy Riot members let out of prison. On the other side of the Olympics, do you see Putin's hand firmer, stronger, even crackdown?
Difficult to say. I mean, I think one of the things behind the releases was that it showed Putin to be very powerful. Not only is he this tough autocrat, but he could be this sort of beneficent czar who can do good things once in a while. It was all about him.
Some terrific perspective on Russia around and behind and in the Olympic Games in Sochi from Gregory Pfeiffer. His book out February 18th is Russians, the People Behind the Power. Gregory Pfeiffer, thank you so much for coming in. Great to have you today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.